All right, I wanted to go ahead and go through the sermon at this time. If you're the type of person that likes titles, you can entitle this one Deliverance. This is the time of year as we start to head into the spring holy days. You already heard it in the sermonette. You'll start seeing more information come out about the spring holy days. We often focus on the story of the Exodus during this period of time, and that's appropriate. It's the deliverance by God of the nation of Israel from Egyptian slavery. It's appropriate again at this time since it commemorates the first recorded Passover and unleavened bread observance. But if we back up a bit, we will see that God has actually delivered his people or people in specific many, many times. And during this time of year, we often talk about pre-Passover trials. Is there anyone in here who has never, I don't want to show of hands, who has never had a pre-Passover trial? I would really like to know how you have avoided that all of these years. Please come and talk to me afterwards. Maybe you can straighten me out. But it seems like this time of year does cause some issues when we have pre-Passover trials that people experience. Often God delivers us in ways that we're not expecting. As we go through trials, we tend to, and I'm just as guilty of this as the next person, I have already decided in my head how I want God to handle the emergency. So as I'm explaining to him this trial that I'm in, I'm also explaining to him, here's how I want it fixed. I don't know that he has ever fixed it the way I've asked him to fix it, but usually he's got a better way of doing that. I want to talk about that today. I want to review several examples. I actually have four or five of them down. Time may not permit me to get to all of them, which is fine. I can just mention them and you can go off and do studies on your own. But when we're finished with the sermon today, I think that we will see what we can and what we should expect from God as he delivers us from our trials. And as I said, the deliverance may not be the way that you think. So let's go through a few examples of this, and I hope that you'll find this interesting. Let's start in Genesis chapter 6. Genesis chapter 6. This is the story of God talking to a man and explaining to him that he wants him to build a big boat. This is the story of Noah. If I were to ask you, as you're turning to Genesis chapter 6, write down who was delivered from this trial, who would you write down? Just think about that. Who did God deliver in this trial? Again, it may not be who you're thinking. By the time it's all said and done, I think you'll see that a lot of things got delivered during this. Before we read the account, who or what was delivered in this story? Genesis chapter 6, let's go to verse 9. Actually, I want to start earlier than that. Let's start in verse 5. It says, "The Eternal saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thought of his heart was only evil continually. And the Eternal was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him in his heart." It had gotten so bad during this period of time that God actually was looking down at the earth and seeing nothing but wickedness, except for one person. Verse 9. This is the genealogy of Noah. Noah was a just man, perfect in his generations, and Noah walked with God. Perfect in his generations. Some people have looked at that in the past and mistakenly thought that that meant that he was racially pure. That's not what this is talking about. If you look at this in other translations, here's the Bible in basic English. It says, Noah was an upright man and without sin in his generation. In other words, he was a righteous man. He was without sin, and he went in the ways of God. So Noah was an exception. Every thought of every person was evil, except for Noah. Apparently, he was the one exception to this. Keep reading, verse 11. The earth was also corrupt before God, and the earth was filled with violence. So God looked upon the earth, and indeed it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth. Notice, and I think it's interesting, it says that the earth was corrupt. Now, we read earlier that the people were corrupt, and we're going to see something here that God is trying to explain to us. It says the earth had become corrupt. And notice it says that all flesh had corrupted it. Look at verse 13. God said to Noah, "The end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them, and behold, I will destroy them with the earth." Now, what does that mean? That God will destroy them with the earth. There's actually two ways that you can translate that. One way is God will destroy the people by having the earth destroy them. In other words, God's going to destroy them with the earth. But there's a second way of looking at this. I want to read this from a couple of different perspectives here. This is from the NIV. Let me read verse 13 from the NIV. So God said to Noah, "I'm going to put an end to all people, for the earth is filled with violence because of them. I am surely going to destroy both them and the earth." The earth had become full of violence. The earth had become a sinful place. The people on the earth had corrupted it. One way of looking at this is that God would not only destroy the people on the earth, but he was also going to destroy the earth. And he did. He did. He destroyed it by this huge flood. And what came out of that was a completely different planet. And he reformed it. We'll get into more of that as we go along. The end of all flesh, meaning all humans, had come upon the earth. Remember, the penalty for sin is death. We talked about that last time. We talked about the two trees and the choice. It isn't that God was being mean. God was being fair. Humanity had corrupted themselves and in the process had corrupted the earth. As I go through this, and you may be able to find more, as I went through this story, I found four different categories of things that were delivered from this trial. How many did you come up with? Now, you may have come up with, well, there's Noah and his wife and his son and his son's wives, and you can count like that. But I came up with four different groups or things that were delivered. So I want to talk about those today, because sometimes, again, when you're in the middle of a trial, you're looking very much at what you're going through and not seeing the bigger picture sometimes. So let's look at this trial that had come upon Noah. Who was delivered during this trial? Here's the first one. God delivered the earth. God delivered the earth. The earth was also in need of being delivered, but so did the sinning humanity. Again, in the NIV, it says that I will surely destroy both the people and the earth. The earth was so bad that God decided to destroy it and start over. Now, that had actually happened once before, you remember? Genesis 1, verse 1, the earth had become without form and void. God created it beautiful, and it got destroyed, and God had to fix it. He's going to do this during the flood. I want to read something from Josephus from Antiquity of the Jews. I always find this interesting. Now, that this isn't holy writ, this isn't canonized, but this is a summation of Jewish lore that was available at the time that Josephus was writing in the 100s AD. Here's what he says. It says, the Jewish Antiquities Josephus unveiled a certain tradition according to which the descendants of Seth, which was the son of Adam and Eve, now I'm quoting from Josephus, discovered the science of the heavenly bodies and their orderly array. At some point in time, the children of Adam, the grandchildren of Adam, looked up and realized this moon kind of happens every so often, and the stars move, and there's planets, and they're doing things that are different than the stars. They used to call them wanderers, right? Because sometimes the planets would appear to go one way, and then another time they would appear to turn around and go another way. And they got interested in that, and they started studying this. Moreover, to prevent their discoveries from being lost to mankind and perishing before they became known, and then there's a parenthetical expression here, and this is what I want to talk about. This is the sons of Seth have figured out the scientific development, and they're afraid that their scientific knowledge is going to get lost. Why were they afraid of that? This is the parenthetical thought. Because their father Adam had predicted a destruction of the universe at one time by a violent fire and at another time by a deluge of water. So according again to Jewish lore, Adam knew that there were going to be two times that the earth was going to be destroyed, once by a flood and once by fire. So out of the parenthetical expression, so the sons of Seth erected two pillars. one of brick and the other of stone, and they inscribed these discoveries on both, so that if the pillar of brick disappeared in the deluge, what was brick back in those days? It was adobe. It was mud. You know, mud is, you know, if you have this deluge of water, all the bricks are going to end up dissolving away. If the pillar of brick disappeared in the deluge, that of stone would remain to teach men what was graven thereupon and to inform them of what had been discovered. So even back a long time before this deluge that occurred that destroyed humanity, Adam had predicted that the earth would again be destroyed, once by fire and once by a deluge of water. And we know that this did happen. We know that this will happen again. We know that there's going to come a time when God's going to have to deliver the earth again. Let's go all the way forward to Revelation chapter 11, and let's read about what is going to happen at some time in the future. Revelation chapter 11, in verse 18. I could take this one verse, and I could put it side by side with the verse in Genesis 6. Notice what it says in verse 18. It says, the nations were angry, and your wrath has come, and the time of the dead that they should be judged, and that you should reward your servants, the prophets, and the saints, and those who fear your name, small and great, that you should destroy those that destroy the earth. That sounds to me like what he was talking about at the time of the flood. The nations had become so bad, the people had become so evil, that they actually had destroyed the earth. The earth was in a state of chaos and mess. And because of that, there would come a time of great trial on them. So what will that great trial be again in the future? Let's go to 2 Peter chapter 3 and let's read about what God has in store for the future of this earth. 2 Peter chapter 3. And let's start in verse 6. And that's kind of in the middle of the thought. But this is talking about, let's go back to verse 1. Behold, now I write to you this second epistle, both which I stir up your pure minds by way of reminder, that you may be mindful of the words which were spoken before by the holy prophets. What was spoken before by the holy prophets? Verse 6, by which the world that had then existed perished, being flooded with water. So we know that the earth actually was destroyed at that time, at least all of the things that were on it. Verse 7, but the heavens and the earth are now preserved by the same word and are reserved for fire until the day of judgment and perdition of ungodly men. I won't go through and read them now, but there are several chapters in the book of Revelation as it talks through the seals and through the trumpets that a third of the trees are going to get burned up, and a third of the fish is going to die, and the earth is going to be burned up yet once again. Verse 10, but the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens will melt away with a great noise, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. Both the earth and the works that are in it will be burned up. God will again destroy the earth. The people of the earth will again be destroying the earth, and God will again destroy the earth, this time by fire. But notice Revelation chapter 21. Here's the good story out of the bad. He does this for a reason. He does this for a reason. Revelation chapter 21, verse 1. And then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away. The earth became so evil that God had to deliver it from that evil. The earth will again become so evil that God will have to deliver the earth. He wants this earth. He created it as a crown jewel. You remember reading in the Old Testament where it said that when the universe was created, when the earth was created, the angels shouted for joy. It was an absolutely beautiful place. But humanity has destroyed it, and God has to deliver it. At the flood, the earth was delivered from future harm, and God started over, wiped everything out. And what we have now, again, is a beautiful jewel. Seeing pictures from space are always amazing to me. I so desperately want to get into space. in human form before I die. I know one of these days I'll get up there and I'll get to see it. But I've heard astronauts say that the first time they get into orbit around the Earth, they realize just how amazingly beautiful this Earth is. And yet, God will have to destroy that because of how evil the Earth will become. And God will have to start over again, once after a flood, once after fire, and he will create a new heavens and a new Earth. So God, during this period of time, delivered the Earth from the violence that was in it. Let's go back to Genesis chapter 6 and verse 13, and let's read about another group that needed deliverance at this time. I talked about this once before in a personal correspondence letter that I got. Now, for those of you that are in Laurel and Covington, you may remember this. Those in Mobile and Dufuniac won't, because I haven't given this one to you guys yet. But remember, I talked about the lady that wrote in and said, how could God have killed all of the innocent children during the flood? Understand the adults. They were evil and they needed to be wiped out, but why did God, the little baby that maybe was only 2 or 3 days old, that baby didn't sin. Why did that baby have to die? Let's look at what it says in Genesis chapter 6 and verse 13 again. And God said to Noah, the end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them. For behold, I will destroy them with the earth. The end of all flesh. God was going to take the people that had corrupted the earth and was going to do away with them. Now, did you catch what we said there? God was going to deliver that generation from their sins by taking their lives. Sounds a little harsh, doesn't it? And yet, if you think about it, that was the absolute best thing that God could have done for an evil and a sinful generation. There are people that look at, I remember one guy wrote in one time and he made the statement. He says, I've read all your literature and I don't believe that a loving God will ever destroy anything. This whole idea in the Bible about this hellfire and people being cast into a lake of fire, that's not the God I serve. But the God I serve isn't that mean. And yet, if you think about it, God not only has done that several times, but will do it again. It's better to wipe out a sinful generation and bring them up in the second resurrection than to let them continue on in their sins. The earth had become so filled with violence, it says that every thought was evil. What would have been the best thing for God to do for a nation like that or a group of people like that? To deliver them from that unhappiness and that unpleasantness and bring them up at a time without Satan. God delivered those evil people into the second resurrection. And they will come back. And again, when they're resurrected, I just have to believe that first thing they're going to notice is they don't have that pull on them because Satan is gone. And they will be able to sense that something is different. That that natural kind of evilness that was in the earth is not there now. In all fairness, it will be the biggest blessing for those people. And I have a feeling that they will thank God for taking their lives back then because they were in complete misery. When you think about people who have suffered through a terrible illness and when they die, often the family that's left say, well, they're not suffering now. When they come up, they'll be in a new body. God delivered the people of the earth. Not only them, but for those who would come after them, God says that there will come a time if they will not do what is right, that he will simply remove their lives. And that will be the best thing. He will deliver them from that evilness. We got a new booklet in the mail just recently, and if you read through that booklet, it describes something similar, that why would God have created us as physical human beings instead of spirit beings to start with? Before we had the chance to make the choice. And what the booklet, Eric Jones talks about that in the booklet, God would not want to have someone live forever in misery. So he created us as humans first. God knew that this was the best thing for them. God delivered a sinful humanity into the second resurrection. So he delivered the earth from further damage by fixing it again. He delivered the people into the second resurrection. Now, God delivers Noah and his family. This is the third thing that's saved. Notice verse 9. Let's go to Genesis 6 and verse 9. This is the genealogy of Noah. He was, and I'm going to insert a word here, he was the one who was just. and he was perfect in his generations. He was a righteous man, and he walked with God. And Noah had three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. It does not say that Shem, Ham, and Japheth were also righteous. In fact, there are some things that occur after the flood that kind of give you an idea that perhaps they had some issues themselves. But how would God deliver Noah into this same fate? Would he allow Noah to die and then resurrect him? He could have done it that way, right? You ever wonder, in the face of a trial, when you're explaining to God, here's how I'd like for you to take care of this? Notice verse 14 and 15. Here's what God told Noah to do. Here's how I'm going to get you out of this. Make yourself a boat of gopher wood. Make rooms, cover it inside and outside with pitch. And this is how you'll make it. And he gives him the description of it. He gives him the definition. God's solution to Noah is for him to build a boat. As God was delivering sinful humanity into the second resurrection, he was also going to deliver one deserving family through this into life. Verse 18, I will establish my covenant with you, and you will go into the ark, you and your sons and your wives and your sons' wives with you. So he was going to deliver one family out of this. Don't have the time to go into it here. The science perhaps is a little flawed, but if you've never seen this, it's an interesting read. There are a couple of scientists that have studied genetics and DNA. And in this one paper that was published not too long ago, it was only about a month or two old, where it was said that because of the DNA in animals and because of the DNA in humans, that you can prove that all humans came from one mating pair and that all animals came from one mating pair. Now, the articles go on to say, we know that's bogus because, and they try and take that all the way back to Adam and Eve. No, sorry, that doesn't go all the way back to Adam and Eve. It comes through Noah and his wife. That's the kingpin there of where everybody would have come from, because everybody else died. And they all came from one pair of animals. It just reminds me of the story of Noah and the ark. Now, the article also goes on to say that this was 200,000 years ago, which would be suspect in us, but I still think it's interesting. Verse 18, I will establish my covenant with you. You will go into the ark, you, your sons, your wife, and your sons' wives with you. I would have never come up with that solution. You can imagine Noah's surprise. Now, there are some people that say that, well, that's natural because Noah was a boat builder. Oh, I'm sorry, it doesn't say that. That's people looking into it and trying to read into this. It does not say anywhere that Noah built boats for a living. Perhaps he did, but it doesn't say that. Again, that's not the solution that I would have come up with, and I'll bet you Noah didn't either. Let's drop down to chapter 9. Genesis chapter 9. And let's start in verse 8. So this is after the flood is over. God spoke to Noah and to his sons with him, saying, and as for me, behold, I will establish my covenant with you and with your descendants after you. So all the rest of the people, again, were delivered into death, into the second resurrection. And God's going to establish his covenant with Noah. Verse 11, I will establish my covenant with you. Never again will all flesh be cut off by the water, by the flood of waters. Never again will there be a flood to destroy the earth. And God said, this is the sign of the covenant which I make between me and you and every living creature that is with you for perpetual generations. I will set my rainbow in the cloud, and it will be for a sign of the covenant between me and the earth. And it shall be when I bring a cloud over the earth that the rainbow will be seen in the cloud, and I will remember the covenant, and I will not destroy the earth again. So God would not cause this problem to happen anymore. His promise, he would never destroy the earth again with a flood. But he also promised to reseed humanity through Noah and his family. So we also see that God delivered Noah and his family. There's one more group that got delivered. We've read past it several times, but sometimes we don't think about this because we're focusing on the story of Noah. Let's go back to chapter 6. And let's notice the fourth group that gets delivered from this tragedy. chapter 6 and verse 17. For behold, I myself will bring floodwaters on the earth to destroy from under heaven all flesh in which the breath of life, everything that is on the earth will die. We talked about that not too long ago. What does the breath of life mean? It means the beings that are on the earth that inspire and expire, they respirate, they breathe. That includes worms, it includes snakes, it includes rabbits and dogs and cats and anything that breathes. They were also going to die. Verse 19. Of every living thing, of all flesh, you will bring two of every sort into the ark to keep them alive with you. They shall be male and female. Of the birds after their kind, of the animals after their kind, of every creeping thing on the earth after its kind, two of every kind will come into you so that you can keep them alive. Otherwise, we wouldn't have any animals to repopulate the earth that God was going to recreate. Verse 21, and you will take for yourself of all food that is to be eaten, and you will gather it to yourself, and it will be food for you and for them. For thus Noah did according to all that God commanded him, so he did. Really love the version of the flood where Jason Robards is Noah, and I think it's his wife says, how are we going to take care of tigers and animals and things like that? And he looks at them and says, well, dear, they're just big cats. We'll feed them milk. And during that whole time, can you imagine being on a boat where you've got rabbits and lambs and all that, and that you've got beasts of prey that are in there at the same time? Would have been quite an interesting thing. I can't imagine what Noah must have been going through. Now, there's no chapter break here from chapter 6 to chapter 7. It just keeps going. Then the Lord said to Noah, come into the ark, you and all your household, because I have seen that you are righteous before me in this generation. So again, he's saying, I'm going to deliver your family. But notice again, verse 2, and you will take with you seven each of every clean animal, male and female, two each of animals that are unclean, male and female, and also each of the birds of the air, male and female, to keep the species alive on the face of the earth. They were also delivered from this. So here you are, you're Noah, or you're Noah's wife, or you're one of Noah's sons or daughters, and you're being tossed to and fro on the waves. How would you have looked at this trial? I know that God has promised to save me and my family, but this doesn't seem like much of salvation. All my friends are gone. All my relatives are gone. I'm stuck on this boat with a bunch of smelly animals. I mean, I just can't imagine that there were times as the sea is tossing and turning and they're wondering about this. It would have taken years for him to have built that ark. It took over a half a year for them floating on the water. For those of you that have ever gone on a week-long cruise, you can get seasick just being on the boat for a little while. Those people that work out on the water, those people that work on oil rigs and stuff, I just can't imagine what it would be like during tempests or storms. Was Noah's faith tested? I would have to imagine that it was. And yet, what God was doing is exactly what he said he would do. He said he would deliver Noah and his family. But God's solution affected more than just Noah. It affected the animals that were on the planet. It affected the evil people that were on the planet, and it even affected the planet itself. God's solution was much bigger than just protecting Noah and his wife. Let's look at another example. This one is even more relevant in one sense. Go to Genesis chapter 37. Genesis chapter 37. This is the story of Joseph. We have a hymn that we sing that talks about this. Genesis chapter 37. Now, toward the end of the sermon, I'm going to talk about points that we should be considering when we're in the middle of a trial. But I want you to think about Joseph and what led up to this. Joseph, at times, wasn't the smartest kid. He had dreams, and the dreams were about how I'm going to be greater than my brother. So, of course, he had to tell his brothers, by the way, I had this dream that I'm going to be greater than you. And he didn't just do it once or twice. I think the brothers could have overlooked. This must have been a recurring theme with Joseph. He kept having dreams and he kept talking about it. So Joseph is sent by his father to go find out where the brothers are. Genesis 37, verse 18. Now when they saw him afar off, even before he came near them, they conspired against him to kill him. For they said to one another, look, this dreamer's coming. Oh, we're not going to listen to this story. Well, I am not listening to this story one more time. You know, I can see Simeon or Levi or whatever. I just can't do it, guys. I know we all said we'd be patient, but we're not doing this. Come, therefore, verse 20, let us now kill him and cast him into some pit, and we will say that some wild beast has devoured them. We'll lie to Dad about it. So they're plotting to take his life. This all had been set up by God for a bigger purpose than just the trial that Joseph was going to go through. Notice verse 21. Even Reuben, in one sense, tries to circumnavigate the plan of God. When Reuben heard it, he delivered him out of their hands, saying, let us not kill him. Let's instead put him in this pit. So you were going to kill him and put him in the pit. Let's just put him in the pit. We'll figure out what to do with him later, because he doesn't want his brother to die. So he's, in one sense, he's doing the admirable thing of trying not to have his brother killed, but he also is having him thrown into a pit where some bad things are going to happen to him. God did not want Joseph to die, but God also did not want Joseph to be released. Could God have looked at that trial and said, nah, Joseph's walking into harm's way. I'm going to cause something to happen that turns him around and goes back. No, he didn't do that. God was going to grant him deliverance, but it was going to be in God's way. Notice verse 25. So Joseph's now in the pit. When they sat down to eat a meal, they lifted their eyes and looked, there was a company of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels, bearing spices, balm, and myrrh, on their way to carry them down to Egypt. Verse 26. So Judah said to his brothers, what profit is there if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother and our flesh. And his brothers listened. The Midianite traders passed by, so the brothers pulled Joseph, lifted him out of the pit, sold him to the Ishmaelites into slavery for 20 shekels of silver, and they took Joseph to Egypt. So Joseph now is not only thrown into a pit, he is now sold into slavery. If you read through the story, and again, I don't have the time to go through all of this, he spends years and years and years in slavery. He would rise to a position of prominence where he would think, oh, I'm the head of the household now. And then Potiphar's wife goes after him, and he ends up getting thrown in prison. And then he gets to be the head of the prison. And the baker and the butler are supposed to help deliver him out, but they forget about it. And he's in prison for years and years and years more. What kind of a trial would this have been for him to have had to have gone through this for years? Now, again, from Joseph's perspective, was he thinking, yeah, God's got something great that's going to come out of this? Now, I think Joseph by this time has forgotten all about the dreams. He's forgotten all about any good coming out of this. And he's probably thinking, this is a life sentence. I'm going to spend the rest of my life in prison. Huge trial for him. Most of us, I think, would have believed that God had abandoned us. He's left me. There's no good to come out of this. I've got a life sentence now. There's nothing good that's ever going to come out of this. But if you skip ahead, you know that a great famine was about to come, and God was going to deliver Joseph, but God was also going to deliver a bunch of other people out of this too. Let's go further. Let's go all the way kind of to the end of this story, Genesis chapter 45. Genesis chapter 45. Now, you remember the story. If you go all the way back to his dreams, he dreamt that his brothers and his father would come and bow down before him. That was the dream that got him into trouble. That actually has now happened. His brothers have come before him. They have bowed before. They don't realize it's Joseph. They think he's Pharaoh's right-hand man, which he was. They're bowing before him. Now, I think this whole thing is now finally starting to make sense to Joseph. He didn't know, up to this point, I don't think he knew what was going on, what God had planned. But now all of a sudden it becomes apparent to him. That's why God left me in that pit. That's why God allowed me to be sold to the Ishmaelites. That's why God let me get taken in by Potiphar and then thrown in prison. And it eventually brought him to Pharaoh, where Pharaoh has dreams. Joseph says, here's what's going to happen, right? Now it's all becoming clear. Chapter 45, verse 1. Then Joseph couldn't restrain himself before those that stood before him, his brothers. And he cried out, "Make everyone go out from before me." So no one stood with him while Joseph made himself known to his brothers. And he wept aloud, and the Egyptians and the house of Pharaoh heard it. Verse 3. Then Joseph said to his brothers, "I am Joseph. Does my father still live?" And a never truer sentence. But the brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed at his presence. That is an understatement. When they finally realized who this guy was, now I think all those dreams that Joseph had was coming back to them. Oh, boy, he was right. So they're both, now they're starting to figure this all out. There was a reason for this trial. There was a reason for me going through this trial. Verse 4, then Joseph said to his brothers, "Please come near to me." So they came near. And then he said, "I am Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into Egypt." Ouch. That perhaps was a little stab of the knife there, but that's okay. Then he said, verse 5, "But now do not therefore be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life." It's becoming apparent now to Joseph, this is why I had to go through this trial. This is why I had to suffer for years. It may have been decades that he was in slavery or in jail or whatever, and yet notice what's come out of this. Verse 6, "For these 2 years the famine has been in the land, and there is still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting. But God sent me before you to preserve a posterity for you, for the earth, to save your lives by a great deliverance." Not only was God going to deliver Joseph from his trial, he was going to deliver Joseph's family. He was going to deliver the nations of Israel and probably Syria and Lebanon and Canaan and the other areas that were also experiencing this. The trial that he went through was for a reason. God delivered more than just Joseph. He also delivered Joseph's family, the peoples of many nations. But I would imagine while Joseph was in the pit, he couldn't see a value or a reason for his trial. And yet there was. God was allowing it to happen. When you're in the middle of your trial, do you see God's hand or working it, or do you see his thumb over you? Sometimes when we're in the middle of a trial, and again, I just would have to imagine, Joseph couldn't have seen what was going to happen here, and yet God was planning something. All right, let's talk about Moses and the children of Israel. Let's go to Exodus chapter 3. This is that time of year where we tend to review this, so let's just look at this a little bit, because I want you to notice what God tells Moses and tells the people of Israel that are in the middle of a severe trial. They are slaves, and they are not only enslaved, but you remember the Pharaoh was ordering that all their firstborn children would be killed, etc. Very hard time for them. Exodus chapter 3, verse 7. The Eternal said, "I have surely seen the oppression of my people who are in Egypt. I have heard their cry because of their taskmasters, and I know their sorrows." So God says, I understand what's going on. Now notice what he says in verse 8. "So I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up into a good land, a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites," and he goes through and talks about them all. "So I'm going to take care of this. I'm going to deliver them." Now, how do you suppose Moses would have seen this? Okay, God's going to deliver us, so let's see it happen. And now he's all excited. My people are going to be delivered. So does God deliver them right then and there? Now, he goes through this whole series of events, and for a reason. You remember when God eventually, and again, for the sake of time, I won't read this, but you remember when God says, "Okay, here's what I want you to do." In Moses' mind, it's like, okay, my people are going to be delivered. I'm just going to stand back and watch this. But God says, "No, I want you to go to Pharaoh." All right, hang on. You want me to do what? No, he's killing people. You remember this? This is the guy who's killing people. I don't want to go talk to him. Find another way. Find somebody else. And he's doing whatever he can to try and get out of this. Go to Exodus chapter 5. I think that while God was telling Moses what he wanted him to do, I think Moses was seeing this as a trial. This was a trial on Moses. This was something he did not want to do. Chapter 5 and verse 22. So Moses returned to the Eternal and said, "Why are you doing this?" Can you imagine talking to God like this? I can just see him say that. "You promised to deliver these people. And you promised when I go to Pharaoh that he'd let the people go. Why are you doing this?" This is a huge trial to Moses. "Why have you sent me?" Verse 23, "For since I came to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he has done evil to this people. Neither have you delivered these people at all. ... like you promised." He saw this as a huge trial. He wasn't looking past what it was that God was going to do. Again, keep going. Chapter 6, verse 1. "Then the Eternal said to Moses, 'Now you will see what I will do to Pharaoh. For with a strong hand he will let them go, and with a strong hand he will drive them out of this land.'" And yet, we don't see that happen until several chapters and several miracles and several problems later. Why did this occur? Why did it take so long? Why didn't God just deliver the nation of Israel? I wanted you to notice several things that happened as a result of the way God handled this trial. Exodus chapter 19, verse 2. Exodus chapter 19, in verse 2. "For they had departed from Rephidim and had come into the wilderness of Sinai and camped in the wilderness. So Israel camped before the mountain of God." So God is going to talk to the children of Israel. Verse 3, "Moses went up to God, and the Eternal called to him from the mountain, saying, 'Thus you will say to the house of Jacob and tell the children of Israel, you have seen what I did to the Egyptians, how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now, therefore, if you will obey my voice and keep my covenant, you will be a special treasure to me above all the earth. And you will be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. And these are the words which you will speak to the children of Israel.'" This was not only a lesson for Moses to learn. This was a lesson for the entire nation of Israel. He did it in such a way that nobody could say, "Well, it was because we mounted this great defense." I don't remember the name of the movie, but there's some movie where... was it Papillon or whatever? Anyway, it was the movie where they're in prison and they're trying to do a prison break. This wasn't because the Israelites were so smart that they figured out how to escape the Egyptians. God actually pinned them up against the Red Sea in a move, a non-militaristic, strategic militaristic move, but God delivered them out of it. He did it on purpose. So not only did this trial occur for Moses' benefit, for Aaron's benefit, for those people that were around, but also for the entire nation of Israel. And notice what happens as a result. Deuteronomy chapter 6. This is now years and years later. Deuteronomy chapter 6 and verse 20. "When your son asks you in time, saying, 'What are the meaning of these testimonies and the statutes and the judgments which the Eternal your God commanded you?' Then you will say to your son, 'We were slaves of Pharaoh in Egypt, and the Eternal brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand, and the Eternal showed signs and wonders before our eyes, great and severe, against Pharaoh, against Egypt and his household. And then he brought us here that he might bring us in and to give us this land which he swore to the fathers.'" There would come a time when these people would tell their children, and their children would tell their children. This trial was also for the children who would never see this. In fact, this trial that occurred to the nation of Israel actually is for us today. When I was a kid growing up in the church, and I can remember going through these stories. Remember the old Bible story books that we had where they would talk about the various things in the Bible? I can remember with fascination thinking as a kid. This was at a time when this civil rights issue was really heating up in the United States. We had the Watts riots and things going on. And I can remember looking at this and saying, you know, my ancestors were slaves once too. And they were delivered by God out of it. This is a good thing. Delivery from slavery is a good thing. I remember that very clearly as a kid, thinking how amazing God was to be able to protect his people. Joshua chapter 9. Let's do one more one more scripture on this. Joshua chapter 9, verse 24 through 26. Joshua 9, verse 24. So they answered Joshua and said, because your servants were clearly so let me back up here. This is a story of a group of people. The Israelites, as they get into the promised land, are told, take over all the cities. Don't make any deals. Don't make any covenants with them. You will displace the people of this land. So you've got these sneaky people that come in, and they bring old bread, and they put old shoes, and they've got old clothes, and then they say, oh, we're not from this land. We're from a faraway land. But notice what it says. So Joshua answered, and so they answered Joshua and said, because your servants were clearly told, the Eternal your God commanded his servant Moses to give you all the land and to destroy all the inhabitants of the land from before you. Therefore, we were very much afraid for our lives because of you and have done this thing. Even the people in the land of Canaan had heard about this story. So this story was more than just for Moses. It was more than just for the children of Israel at the time. This was spread throughout the land that God takes care of his people. This was even a lesson to non-God-fearing people that had pagan gods as their gods. They knew that God had protected the nation of Israel. So Moses and the children of Israel were protected. They were delivered. But that deliverance is there for us in stories today as well. Let's do one more example, and then we'll start to summarize this. Let's look at the situation with Sodom and Gomorrah. How would God take care of this? Go back to Genesis chapter 18. I always find this interesting when I read through this account. I think that Abraham at the time probably knew that at the very least these were angels, but at the most he probably knew that this was God himself. Genesis 18, verse 22 through 24. Then the men turned away from there and went toward Sodom, but Abraham stood before the Lord. Now, again, this doesn't say this explicitly, but I almost think that as these three are turning to go toward Sodom, that Abraham gets between them and stops them. It's like he's putting his hands up and saying, hang on a minute. Verse 23, and Abraham came near and said, would you also destroy the righteous from the wicked? Suppose there are 50 righteous within the city. Will you destroy that place and not spare it for the 50 righteous that are in it? Why was he doing this? Because he had relatives that were in the area, Lot and his family. Abraham's reaction, that might have been our reaction too. No, 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 this is too big a trial. I want you to grant deliverance. I've got relatives in there, and I want you to deliver my relatives. So Abraham is giving God, here's the solution to this problem. Don't destroy it because Lot's there. Well, God's got a different plan. God's going to do things differently. To Abraham, this trial was about Lot, but to God, this was much bigger. God's decision, again, was just. The best thing, if you look back at the instance of the flood, the best thing for the people of Sodom and Gomorrah was for them to be destroyed or to be delivered into the second resurrection. I actually want you to notice that. Go to Matthew chapter 10. Matthew chapter 10. There are people who read the story of Noah and the people that died in the flood, or read about God destroying Sodom and Gomorrah, and they don't think about the fact that these people are going to come up again. And they will. Matthew chapter 10 and verse 15. Assuredly, I say unto you, it will be more tolerable for the land of Sodom and Gomorrah in the day of judgment than it is for that city. The people that died in Sodom and Gomorrah, the people that died in the flood, will be resurrected again, and they will be judged. And there will be a time of judgment. You think about Sodom and Gomorrah and all of the sins, and yet Christ says, it's going to be better off for them than for you. Why? When they come up, they're going to repent. You Sadducees and Pharisees, you know who I am. He basically said that to them several times. You know who I am, and yet you're still refusing to obey me. It's going to be more tolerable for Sodom and Gomorrah in the day of judgment than for you. the deliverance that God is going to give Sodom and Gomorrah was more than just the deliverance of Lot. The best thing for the people of the cities at that time was to be destroyed. They were that evil. But also, the best thing for Lot to happen was for Lot to get out of Sodom and Gomorrah. And he did. He left. The deliverance was affected more than just Lot. When God delivers people, he delivers people. Again, I won't go through them all, but if you read through Joshua and Judges and you count the number of times that God delivered Israel's enemies into their hands. I was talking to someone this week about the story of Gideon. I know we've gone through that before, where he starts out with an army of whatever it is. I don't remember, 30,000 people, some amazing. And I think Gideon's all pumped. We're gonna go kick these people out, and we're going to take over, et cetera. And God goes, no, there's too many people. And he says, what are you talking about? He says, just tell the people if they want to go home, they can. And 20,000-something people go back home. And I'm sure from Gideon's perspective, it was like, oh. And then God says, it's still too many. And he keeps narrowing it down and narrowing it down and narrowing it down. Finally gets down to 300 people, and then he tells them, now you're going to go into battle. And guess what you're going to take? You're going to take a trumpet, and you're going to take a milk jug with a candle in it. Where's the swords? Where's the bazookas? Where's the tanks? Where's the air coverage? Where's the command and control? He does this completely different than what Gideon is expecting. But he delivers his people in the way that he wants them delivered. Read through those. It's amazing. Let's go to the New Testament as we start to wrap this up. Hebrews chapter 11. Hebrews chapter 11. This is this wonderful section where the writer of the book of Hebrews goes through and starts listing all of the things that God did for his people. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 32. What more shall I say? For the time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah and David and Samuel and the prophets. And he starts listing these things. Boy, you go through and you look at God's deliverance, and it's amazing. Verse 33. Who through faith subdued kingdoms, worked righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, became valiant in battle, turned to flight the armies of the aliens. Women received their dead raised back to life again. The deliverance that God gave his people is completely enumerated. You want to be inspired? Just read through some of those books of the Old Testament and see how God took care of his people. But notice second half of verse 35 and on. But others were tortured, and they didn't accept deliverance. There were people that God did allow to suffer, that they may obtain a better resurrection. And what trial are we going through now? And will God deliver us? Yeah, he's going to deliver us. It may be now. It may be tomorrow. It may be 10 years from now. It may be in the kingdom of God. But he'll take care of it. He is in charge. Others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection. When I was listening to Mr. Franks talk about what the Sabbath keepers had to go through in the early days of the United States, it reminded me of even just a few hundred years before that, when the Inquisition was going on. And Sabbath keepers were wiped out in France. And they were committed to torture. You will either recant and come back to the Catholic Church, or you will die. And many of them, wanting to obtain a better resurrection, allowed themselves to go through that. Verse 36, still others had a trial of mocking and scourging, of chains and imprisonment. You ever been mocked for your beliefs? I was back in school. I know I've talked about that before, where I had teachers that would publicly mock me for going to the feast because I didn't believe in evolution and I believed in some crazy God. Mockings and scourgings, yes, and of chains and imprisonment. Some people even had to go to jail over this. Think of the Apostle Paul and all that he had to go through. They were stoned. They were sawn in two. They were tempted. They were slain with the sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, and tormented, of whom this world was not worthy. They wandered in deserts and mountains and dens and caves. But all of these, having obtained a good testimony through faith, did not at that time receive the promise. For God, having provided something better for us, that they should not be made perfect apart from us. The second resurrection is coming. The first resurrection is coming. The time when we will look at what God is doing for us and we will finally understand it. I still think, and I believe this wholeheartedly, I know some of you are going through some pretty serious health trials. Some point in the future, maybe after you're resurrected, the trials that you're going through will have affected those people around you and they will have learned from it. I've seen some people that have gone through some serious health trials in the church, and I've looked at their faith and what that did to the people around them. I have seen this, and you probably have too, where prior to the person's death, the family members weren't attending church, but when they saw what their mom or dad went through or whatever, after their death, then they started to get back into it. You know, their parents don't even realize that now. They're in the grave waiting for a resurrection. They'll probably be surprised when they come up and say, "You started coming back to church? Why didn't you do that years before when I was still alive and could have seen it?" What you see out of trials is not what you expect. It's what God is working, and you don't know what that is. You have no idea what that is yet, because you may not see it in this life, but it will happen. 1 Corinthians chapter 10. In verse 11. It says, all these things happened to them. The people that you see all of these amazing stories. The examples of the people that had to suffer for the truth of God and for the truth of the kingdom of God and for what Jesus Christ had to even suffer. All these things happened to them as examples, and they're written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. There are examples that we can follow, and they should inspire us. When I look at what Joseph went through, I'll go back to him again, sitting in that pit, he had no idea what God was doing. He had no idea that there was going to be an end to this that would save thousands and thousands of people. I'm sure as he was going through it at the time, he was just sick to his stomach and thinking, what have I done? Why did I have to tell him about those dreams? And he probably was kicking himself in one regard. What I want to do is, I still have some scriptures to go through, but what I wanted to do is just give you five quick points as you are going through your pre-Passover trials, whatever they may be. Some thoughts to remember as you ask God for deliverance. And we do, and we should do that. Whenever we go to God and we're in the middle of a trial and we ask for deliverance, I want you to remember five things when you're asking for deliverance. Here's the first point. Will God's intervention only help me? It's very, very easy for us to get narrowly focused. We're in the middle of a trial. Is what I'm going through, and God, I'm requesting that you deliver me, is that the only people that are going to be helped by this trial? Will God's intervention only help me? Who else is involved? How might they also benefit from this? Look at the number of times in the Bible when a deliverance for an affected individual also helped others. Think back to, again, to Joseph. I want to turn to two scriptures. I think this is interesting. Let's go to 1 Peter chapter 3. These both basically say the same thing. 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 1 and 2. This is talking about wives submitting to husbands who perhaps are not the greatest guys in the world, and they're suffering through, as it were, a bad marriage. It says, wives, likewise, be submissive to your own husbands. Why? So that even though they don't obey the word, they, without a word, may be won over by the conduct of their wives. As you're going through this trial, what effect are you having on other people? Are they seeing God's faith? Are they seeing God's righteousness? Are they seeing God's handiwork in this? And will that someday affect them to where they will be won over by your conduct? It could be that this trial that you're going through is not for you. It could be, think about this, What if the trial you're going through is because God is calling someone else? And your trial and the way you handle it is going to be what they see that brings them into this way of life. How do you know that that's not what God's doing? Maybe it's the kids. Maybe it's the parents. Maybe it's the neighbor. Who knows? 1 Corinthians chapter 7. We'll see something else that's very similar to that. 1 Corinthians chapter 7. In verse 12. Again, for the sake of time, I won't read all the way through this, but this is talking about if a woman has a husband who doesn't believe. That's what you see in verse 15. Drop down to verse 13. Drop down to verse 15. If the unbeliever departs, let him depart. A brother or a sister isn't under bondage in such cases, but God has called us to peace. But notice verse 16. For how do you know, O wife, whether you will save your husband, or how do you know, O husband, whether you will save your wife? The idea is God will eventually work with all people. The people maybe that you're struggling with right now, God is, not will, he is working with them. He may not be calling them right now, but he's setting things up. I look back at people that I know that have died. I use my father as an example. A lot of stuff happened, and he died never having been called by God at the time. But when he's resurrected, all those things are going to come flooding back into his mind because God, through his plan, has set him up to be called, and it will happen one of these days. And hopefully, I won't be an impedance to that. That's the last thing I want is for God to say, you know, despite Phil, I called Dick Sandilands. I really don't want to hear that from God one of these days. That's not my intent in all of this. Will God's intervention only help me? Is this trial that I'm going through about me? Or is this trial setting something up for God to be able to work with somebody else in the future? Second point, pray for help to learn from the trials and not to get discouraged. It's very, very easy to get discouraged. Hebrews chapter 12 in verse 1. Hebrews 12 in verse 1. Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let's lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race set before us. Look to Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before them endured the cross. The joy of the kingdom of God. The goal is the kingdom of God. Whatever trial we're going through now, it should teach us, and hopefully it will be a help and an encouragement to others. But we have to stay focused. Jesus Christ endured the cross, despised the shame, but sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. That's what you have in store for you as you're going through your trial. The kingdom of God is coming. This period of time, this 80 years or so that we live, is a very short period of time. What we have waiting for us is much greater than the trial that we're going through now. Pray for help that you don't get discouraged. Point three, as we pray for guidance in getting out of the trial, ask God to show us what we might have done to contribute to the trial. Now, let's go back to the story of Joseph. Was it really intelligent for Joseph to over and over and over again remind his brothers about this dream that he had where he was going to rule over them? Now, at some point, Joseph probably should have said, I'm making my brothers mad. At one point, it says that his father even got irritated at him. Joseph wasn't probably the smartest, the sharpest knife in the drawer when it came to keeping his mouth shut. What have we done that maybe could have caused this? Look at James chapter 1. James chapter 1, this is the famous section where James talks about looking in a mirror. James 1, verse 22, when you're in the middle of a trial, look in the mirror. Verse 22, be doers of the word and not hearers only, deceiving yourselves. For if anyone is a hearer of the word and not a doer, he's like a man who observes his natural face in a mirror. So you're in the middle of a trial, you look in the mirror, you see some dirt, and instead of taking care of the dirt, you just walk away. He observes himself, but then he goes away and immediately forgets what kind of man he was. But he who looks into the perfect law of liberty and continues in it, he is not a forgetful hearer, but a doer of the work. This one will be blessed. So as you're going through a trial, look and say, what did I do that helped contribute to this? Guess what? That trial will probably come up again sometime in the future. But if you learn the lesson this time, the next time it comes around and you say, aha, last time this didn't turn out so well, I'm going to do it differently this time. Try and learn what you might have done that helped contribute to the trial. Point four, cast your cares upon God, for he cares for you. 1 Peter chapter 5. 1 Peter chapter 5, verses 5 and 6. It's a very simple statement, and yet there's a lot in here if you recognize what's being said. 1 Peter 5, verses 5 and 6. Likewise, you younger people, submit yourselves to your elders. Yes, all of you be submissive to one another and be clothed with humility. For God will resist the proud, but he'll give grace to the humble. What is he looking for in whatever trial you're going through? Is he looking for you to be proudly defiant? I'm going to beat this. I'm going to do this or do that. No, he's looking for you to have a different attitude. Verse 6, therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you in due time. Your time will come. The trial that you're experiencing will go away, but it will happen if you're humble before God. Verse 7, and cast your cares upon him because he cares for you. At times when we're going through things, it may seem like I have goofed this up so badly that God's not involved in this anymore. He's just left me. Brethren, that is not the case. He has not left you. There is a reason behind this. There is a reason behind all the trials that we go through. Think past the trial. Think past this life. Think about the first resurrection. Think about the second resurrection. Think about the effect that this has, not only on you, but on all people. And then cast your care upon God, for he cares for you. And finally, point number 5, through this trial, pray for faith and for patience. Let's end in 2 Thessalonians chapter 1. 2 Thessalonians 1, and let's read verses 3 through 7. The heading in my Bible says, God's final judgment and glory. This is what we have to look forward to. 2 Thessalonians 1, verses 3 through 7. We are bound to thank God always for you, brethren, as it is fitting, because your faith grows exceedingly, and the love of every one of you abounds toward each other. As we go through things, the good and the bad, we grow and we get closer together. Verse 4, so that we ourselves boast of you. Paul's saying that I talk about you to the other churches. I tell them about your patience and your faith. I talk about the persecutions and the trials that you've had to endure. But through those trials and persecutions, you've maintained a faithfulness. Now look at verse 5, which is manifest evidence of the righteous judgment of God. God allowed them to go through these. That the trial that he gave them was just, but it was for a reason, that they could develop patience and they could develop faith. That you may be counted worthy of the kingdom of God, for which you also suffer. It's making a better person out of you. It's setting an example for others to see. And while others may not see it today, they will see it tomorrow or the next year or in the resurrection. There will come a time when they will look back at this and see. Verse 6. Since it is a righteous thing with God to repay with tribulation those who trouble you. People that are giving you grief will stand before the throne of God one of these days, and they will get their talking to. But they'll get they're talking to from a just God who is working with them and calling them and trying to help them to understand. Verse 7, to give those who are troubled rest with us when the Lord Jesus is revealed from heaven with his mighty angels. Pre-Passover trials, of course. They happen more than just on Passover, but yes, we go through them, and that is a reality. They're nothing new. Whatever you may be going through, whether it's family issues or health issues, they're nothing new. There's nothing new under the sun, as as we were told in Ecclesiastes. But they can and they will serve God's purpose. If we can step back and we can look at what God is doing and be amazed by it, our Father in heaven is in control and he will deliver us.